It is Sunday, May 5th, 2013, and this is episode 17 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. As always, the thoughts and opinions I express on this podcast are mine and don't represent those of my employer. So the first most pressing thing that we need to get out of the way is, what am I drinking tonight? And I'm really glad you asked. I am currently drinking a Mike's Hard Lemonade Frozen. These things are really good, and they're even better when you put a little bit of Grey Goose in there. All right, the first story we're going to talk about tonight is Twitter. And over the past couple of weeks, we've talked about some stories about different high-profile Twitter accounts being hacked, primarily media. And as you'll recall, the Associated Press had their Twitter account compromised, and that actually ended up impacting the stock market and causing a bit of a chaos. So Twitter put out a notice to different media agencies that they really need to improve their security discipline and how they manage their Twitter account. And interestingly, the guidance they gave was to use a dedicated PC, one that was only used to access that particular Twitter account. Not for checking email, not for surfing the internet, not for using Facebook, just for interacting with that particular Twitter account. It seems like fairly familiar guidance to me, and really I think it's a good idea. Some of the backlash against this advice is that it's really not realistic, especially in a news situation. You may have different people in different environments who need to post things, and they can't really necessarily carry multiple systems with them. You know, my take on that is, you know, if you can't do this, if you can't come up with a way to insulate the system that is accessing this very important and sensitive resource, you basically are accepting the fact that the account is likely to get compromised. And I would say, especially for the larger media agencies, there's a lot of different ways to skin this cat. There's virtual machines that can be run on a particular system. So if you have journalists that need to be out in the field, teach them how to use VMware or VirtualBox or something like that so they can fence off different kinds of activities and hopefully avoid some cross-contamination. My concern really, though, is how these breaches are happening. And I strongly suspect that it's either happening by an email or by a direct message on Twitter. And the direct message takes the person to some social engineering page that looks an awful lot like a Twitter page, maybe has a similar Twitter URL, and tricks the person into entering their username and password. The problem there is that can even happen on an isolated system. So you still have to have some amount of discipline on what you click on. But my guess is it's probably something coming in by email. And so if you segregate email off from the system that's being used to manage the Twitter account, you're probably not bad off. Now, there's been a fairly strong renewed call for Twitter to put in two-factor. You know, the problem there is that solves half the problem, right? So if the attack is to steal the username and password so that someone can then remotely take over the account from some other location, that's useful. However, if you have a man on the PC type of situation where the computer or a computer that is authorized to access this Twitter account, and that system gets compromised with a poison ivy or one of the many other remote access trojans, basically, once the user has authenticated, even with two-factor, now the attacker actually has access to the account. Now, granted, they have to do it at a point where someone is actually logged in, but it's still not impossible. I would still say that if you have a Twitter account or any other account that can move the stock market, whether or not there's two-factor authentication, you really probably ought to be doing that on a dedicated system where people aren't browsing the internet or checking their email. And, to make it applicable more broadly, you could replace Twitter account with server administrator or database administrator, or insert whatever critical function or critical access your particular business has. And so this dovetails very nicely into the second story, which is that a Department of Labor, a U.S. Department of Labor website, the Site Exposure Matrices, was compromised and basically coded to use a previously unknown exploit in Internet Explorer 8. So apparently this attack is focused on nuclear type engineers. Apparently the kinds of data being served on this particular site are commonly accessed by that type of person. Apparently there were two specific URLs on the Department of Labor site that were compromised and redirected to another site which dropped an EXE, and that EXE exploited a vulnerability in Internet Explorer 8, which, by the way, has yet to be patched. Keep that in mind. And then opens some remote command and control channels. Fairly standard fare from there, I think. So this is yet another example of a perfectly legitimate, valid website being compromised in what's quickly becoming the stereotypical watering hole attack. Attackers decide what kind of person they want to go after and focus their effort on attacking a particular kind of website that those people congregate at. So at the time of the attack, or early in the attack, a fully patched system running antivirus hitting on the site would likely have become compromised if it was running Internet Explorer 8. I suppose if you're running application whitelisting and web filtering with unknown domains or known malware domains turned on, you may be okay. But again, if you don't have protections in place that you're confident are going to stop this kind of thing, you really have to think long and hard about whether your employees should be going out to the internet, even to valid sites. And that's really going to come down to your particular business. What kind of things do you stand to lose? What's the trade-off? No one can really sit here, and especially me, and tell you that you have to disable web browsing. I can't. Nobody really has that good of a view across all different organizations. This is really something that each organization needs to internalize, determine for your specific case what's appropriate for you. I mean, given the fact that legitimate sites are getting compromised, and they're getting compromised in such a way that they're exploiting problems in legitimate software, which there's no patch for. So you have to keep that in mind. It's not acceptable to say, well, you know, I've got antivirus running on my systems and we patch, you know, as soon as Microsoft or, you know, insert vendor name here, as soon as they release a patch, we apply it across the environment. You know, therefore, we feel we're good. The reality is you're not good. There's still a lot of exposure, but that might be okay. Or maybe it makes sense to somehow segregate different duties onto different systems. Again, maybe using some kind of virtualization. All right, the next story comes from the BBC. There's a middle school called the Schoenbar Middle School in Alaska, where 18 12 to 13-year-olds are accused of social engineering by way of phishing their teachers and obtaining access to some 300 PCs. There's very little detail on what actually happened, but we can assume they probably did it in an attempt to change their grades or something similar to that. It's also really not known how they perpetrated this. You know, did they use the social engineering toolkit? Did they just mock up a message in an email and send out some crazy form, go into a Google Apps spreadsheet where people entered their usernames and passwords? There's really no information, but the thing I find interesting here is you have 12 and 13-year-olds tricking grown adults. I think that's fairly telling on how substantial the problem of phishing is. I can't imagine that these kids did anything that was really, really sophisticated to the level of some of the things that the criminals are doing. And so that, to me, gives some perspective on how significant the problem is. All right, the next story is about iOS malware. This story is just lighting up the internet lately. And I find it interesting because I have a lot of discussions with people about the relative merits of Android versus iOS. And there's report after report that shows how much worse off iOS is than Android. And it's kind of an odd situation because we know that there are just a preponderance of malware for Android, and there's very, very little for iOS, and almost none if you are not using a jailbroken iOS device. So this story was actually kind of novel because it pointed out that, hey, there's malware in a legitimate application. The name of the application is Simply Find It, and it's about $2 on the iOS store. And the interesting thing is, there isn't actually any malware. So what happened was, someone apparently downloaded the app to their Mac, they unpacked it, and they scanned it with an antivirus engine, and antivirus triggered on it. What was being triggered on was a reference inside an MP3 file that had the text of an iframe to a known bad site. The problem is, while that sounds pretty bad, it actually doesn't do anything. So, to the best of what I can divine out of the articles I've read, whoever compiled this application probably had some malware on their system, and this MP3 had an iframe appended to it inside the actual file. Now, that iframe doesn't actually do anything in the context of the iOS application. So to say it has malware, I think, is quite a far stretch. And I bring that up because I think it pays to have some skepticism on some of the things we read about, especially salacious stories about iOS having malware. Now, I'm not a big iOS fanboy. I do like my iPad a lot. But, you know, I am realistic in the sense that at some point we're going to see some real successful attacks against iOS, but we're not there yet. And, you know, I know this is like the, you know, the doomsday preppers who are really hoping for the, you know, the earth to open up and start swallowing cities. You know, people are really sitting around just waiting for iOS to start having some major problems, but you know, we're not there yet. Someday we will. Let's be skeptical about the motives of people who are claiming that iOS has malware until it's really proven that it's there. The next story is from InfoWorld, and it's about basically the impact of the end of life of Windows XP coming and how that's affecting some vendors and what their plans are. So in this particular case, there's a concern that antivirus manufacturers are starting to cease support for Windows XP. You know, obviously, antivirus is becoming a fairly competitive market. So you don't, as a antivirus writer, you don't want to be supporting non-strategic platforms, like, for instance, Windows XP. And we know that Windows XP is where a bulk of the problems are. So obviously, there's probably a disproportionate amount of effort that has to go into supporting antivirus on XP. So this is kind of creating a tough situation for people who are still using Windows XP, as we may see some of the, maybe many of the antivirus companies starting to retreat from fully supporting XP. That could create some real big problems over the next 12 months. You know, this really shows from an IT perspective, we have to be pragmatic that even though we found an OS like XP that's really suited to our business, we have to be pragmatic that we got to move off, right? We can't stay there forever. And getting lulled into this sense of complacency and obviously trying to save money is, in the long term, not a good strategy. I think we can all ask valid questions about the macro environment of, you know, do we need to keep coming up with new operating systems every 2 years? That's, that question aside, you know, they're coming out and the bridges are being burned behind us. We've got to move. And I think it's incumbent on us as security practitioners to really help our businesses understand the risk and not making those moves. You know, these are some fairly significant business strategy kinds of discussions that have to be had. A lot of organizations have a lot invested, and the thought of moving from XP to 7 or 8 is a very, very expensive proposition, but an important one nonetheless. All right, the next story comes from Wired. The net of this is a U.S. government contractor named Kinetic had been significantly compromised for many years. There's quite a number of different interesting angles to this story, not the least of which is it came to light because of the H.B. Gary email compromise. So allegedly from 2007 until 2010, the Chinese hacking group, lovingly known as the Comet Crew, apparently had a presence on Kinetic's network and had been stealing their intellectual property for quite some time. And their intellectual property includes things like drone technology, robotics, satellite-based espionage, and the U.S. Army's combat helicopter fleet. So fairly significant and important things to keep secret. And you might be saying, wow, that's terrible. And I'll say, but wait, there's more. So apparently, Comet Crew in China wasn't the only one on their network. Apparently, Russia also had compromised the PC of a secretary at Kinetic and had been siphoning data also. So Kinetic apparently hired H.B. Gary sometime in the 2010 timeframe, and there were some fairly colorful exchanges back and forth. One of them from a H.B. Gary security person, basically saying that all their code and trade secrets are gone. And the article goes on to point out that there has been no repercussions to this company by the U.S. government. And as well, in May of 2012, Kinetic was granted a $4.7 million contract to help protect the U.S. critical transportation infrastructure from cyber attacks. Well, I guess they do have some experience with handling cyber attacks, so maybe it's not all bad. All right, the next story comes from Network World, and it is the 7 elements of a successful security awareness program. And I'll just run through what those elements are real quick. I would invite you to read the article. Number 1, you need C-level support. I think that is very critical. Having executive support is almost an imperative in any kind of security awareness program. Number 2, partner with key departments. Basically, that means HR and legal. And those are important because they help add some muscle and weight behind your education program. Number 3 is creativity. I think that's really important. I've mentioned a couple of times where I thought there's some opportunity. For instance, the Delta Airlines has their new safety videos, which have some fairly unique humor to it that keeps you paying attention. So making it creative and engaging is definitely something I think that's very important. Number 4, metrics. This basically says, how do you know if your training program is effective? How do you know where you need to focus? And so this is basic security 101 type stuff where you really need to have a understanding of what's happening in your environment so that you have the ability to produce such metrics and identify how different programs are overall impacting your security program. Number 5 is become the department of how. Don't become the department of no. Instead, show people what they should be doing, not telling them what they shouldn't be doing. I think that makes a lot of sense. Number 6 is 90-day plans, and this is opposed to the normal annual cycle. So keeping things frequent and reinforced is very important. And the last one is multimodal awareness materials. So that's, in my mind, kind of back to creativity to an extent. But this is online training classes. This is posters and emails and blogs and podcasts and things like that that all work as a comprehensive program to deliver the key message points that you're trying to get out to your community. The next story is a follow-up on the Living Social breach. Again, 50 million accounts compromised. There was some analytics done on the list of users and their salted passwords, hashed and salted passwords. And a security company found that about 60% of the Living Social's 50 million accounts were reusing their passwords on other sites. And that the average number of sites people use their the same password on is 49 different websites. So I'm going to get on my knees and beg and plead, please, 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 please get the message out that people need to be using different passwords for every site. It's so important. All right, the last story I've got comes from the online site Quartz. And this article is about the worst possible cybersecurity breaches could be far worse than you imagined. So the reporter interviews a former DHS person, and he gives some interesting scenarios, which I think are worth talking about just for perspective. The first is spreading disinformation on trusted sites about different geopolitical situations that could create some destabilization. So, you know, for instance, what if the AP had announced that North Korea had launched missiles instead of there being a bomb in the White House? Might that have incented someone in South Korea to respond with an attack? I'd like to think not, but, you know, who knows for sure until that kind of situation happens. The next bullet is, again, attacks on industrial control systems and other embedded networks like the SWIFT banking system here in the U.S. And could a successful attack against one of those systems create a significant enough disruption to harm the economy? Another one, which is kind of an interesting play on the BitTorrent type of thing, is disrupting trading on one of the major stock exchanges, New York, London, Tokyo, and not just disrupting the trading, but also figuring out a way to wipe out transaction history. And, you know, think about something like, and by the way, I'm expanding on what's there, right? Think about what happened in South Korea being used against one of these large exchanges. You could definitely see how this would create a very bad situation, and obviously that would not be a good situation. And the last point he made was that it could be possible to disrupt space-based navigation systems, and that might be used to misguide ordnance or missiles which rely on GPS. And, you know, I hope that most of the governments have gotten the message from some of the disclosures and science experiments that have happened over the past year, where people have shown how they can use software-defined radios to fake GPS signals. So there's some interesting possibilities there. I think taking it over on a geographical scale would be really difficult, but certainly on a very targeted scale is relatively simple. I suppose the point here is, well, what if somebody compromised the network of GPS satellites? That could be really bad. There are other things that aren't on this list, like, well, what about the core time servers? And we saw back a couple of months ago, there was a bad change in the time zone, I believe it was, and that caused some systems to crash. I suspect those things are somewhat rife for attack. So I think there's problems under lots of different rocks, and they have different levels of ability to disrupt our lives. The point of the article, I think, is that our daily lives have become much more reliant on technology than we might be aware of, and a sophisticated and coordinated attack could actually be very disruptive. You know, again, I think these are worst case scenarios, and I don't think that we're going to see a lot of these things happening anytime soon, but I fully anticipate that there are teams of people thinking long and hard about how to do this kind of stuff. And so we need to be cognizant of that and, you know, defend our little area of the world as good as we can, because it's all interconnected. All right, well, that's all for this week. It is time to hit the bed. I look forward to talking to you again next week. Please, if you have any feedback, any comments, any questions, send me an email at info@defensivesecurity.org. Send me a tweet at DefensiveSec. The website is www.defensivesecurity.org. You can find show notes, you can find back episodes, you can find links to subscribe in iTunes. You can find lots of stuff that I have accumulated from the internet and linked from that site. Next week, I hope to get back on the bandwagon of giving some book reviews. I had another pretty challenging week last week, and so I haven't had a lot of chance to do many of the things I would like to do. Anyhow, I hope everyone has a great week, and I will talk to you again next week. Take care. Bye.